Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 3rd of June. Our guest would have you for a moment think about the people who fix our cars, who unclog our toilets, who build our houses. We idealize such workers as the salt of the earth and emphasize the sacrifice for others that their work may entail. He says that some do occur, hazards faced by a lineman restoring power during a storm. But what if such work answers as well to a basic human need of the one who does it, to be of use? The pitcher longs for water to carry and a person for work that is real beneath our gratitude for the lineman may indeed rest envy. Matthew Crawford is our guest this hour. He's the author of the extremely interesting and getting rave reviews, Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work. He has a very interesting background. He has a PhD in political philosophy from the University of Chicago. He was a postdoctoral fellow on its Committee on Social Thought, a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia. But for a long time now, he's worked with motorcycles, and he is the owner and operator of Shakomoto, which is an independent motorcycle repair shop in Richmond, Virginia. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Matthew, author of Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work, and welcome phone calls. I think we're going to get tons of phone calls on this. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Matthew. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Why don't you start by just telling us a little bit of the story of your work life, because you've gone in so many directions, and it seems an unlikely story, but then you read it and you say, oh, yeah, this makes perfect sense.
Well, I'm glad to hear it makes sense. the book sort of takes off from noticing that we've got this distinction of knowledge work versus manual work, as though they were two very different things. And just from my own experience, I find that that's not a distinction that really holds up, because there's a lot of thinking that goes on in the trades. Say you're trying to, diagnose why a car doesn't idle properly. It's not a trivial matter. So out of my work experience, which I guess we can get into, it seems like using your hand and using your mind are actually deeply connected. So for anyone who does like to use their mind at work, I just want to say that the trades can be a life that's worth choosing.
Mm-hmm. And you've always, even when you were in high school, right, you were working on cars then.
Yeah, one of my first jobs was at a Porsche repair shop. It was an independent Porsche shop when I was 15. And I didn't actually learn that much. I was sort of a slave. The owner of the shop lived above the shop, and so at first he had me just cleaning his apartment up there. And eventually I started, packing wheel bearings, learning to do a brake job. But then it was a little bit later that I had a real mentor who taught me how to rebuild a Volkswagen engine, and he was part of the whole VW hot rod scene.
Oh.
And so he sort of initiated me into that, and that was very exciting when I was 17.
I think it takes an incredible, I can't believe people can fix cars and fix motorcycles. The knowledge that you must have to do that, and then you got to try something, and in some cases it doesn't work, so you have to learn from your failure. I would think it's an incredibly complex mental task.
It often is, and, in the service manuals, they'll usually give you sort of a decision tree for where you're trying to eliminate variables systematically, if say you're trying to diagnose something. But often that clean image of diagnostic work kind of breaks down because, especially working on older machines, there's often circumstances that mean that, say you've got stripped screws or bolts, which happens all the time, you may not be able to take off some cover to investigate, one of these variables. So you got to kind of decide what to do in the situation. And that kind of mechanical work, I think, can never be reduced to simply following a procedure. And I think that's one source of its satisfaction. Mm. So much work does get kind of reduced to following rules.
Mm-hmm. And yet I'm wondering, considering the fact that classes in this, you can go to technical schools in the state of Wisconsin, but when I was growing up, there were shop classes, which of course girls couldn't take. We had to take home ec, and I was very upset that I didn't get a chance to take shop. But I'm wondering where... Because we emphasize this, get the knowledge, you got to go to college, you can't get a job unless you go to college. There are some skills that you need to know about how things work. Where do we learn all of this now?
Yeah, well, I guess there's sort of two ways to think about that. One is, sort of the whole question of work and whether, where are you going to get the training to, become a mechanic or an electrician. And the other is sort of our efforts at self-reliance as consumers. And I hope we can talk about both of them. But you just mentioned this fact that shop classes have kind of disappeared from schools. I mean, it's more true in some states than others, but there was a wide sort of effort at dismantling shop class in the 90s to make room for computer classes. And at the same time, I think we were developing this idea that there's really only one track to success, and it runs through college. And I think we need to just take a broader view of what a good job might consist of and the different ways to make one's way in the world and have a good life.
Mm-hmm. And you've done both, certainly. Can you tell us... It's one of those absolutely bizarre experiences that you had as a worker in California, I believe it was, where you were trying to write summaries in a way of texts, and it didn't necessarily matter what you wrote. You just had to write a lot of them, and your coworkers were an unusual lot, and what you were doing was a pretty unusual thing.
Yeah, I got a master's degree. This was in the early 90s. And so I landed this job writing these summaries of articles in scientific journals and other academic journals, and it sounded like an exciting job. I thought I would be learning a lot.
Sure.
By reading all these.
All the journals, yeah.
But as it turned out, my quota after 11 months of being there was 23 articles per day. And if that sounds impossible, it's because it was. So the way the job was set up was that I was told, well, here's a set of sort of rules for taking an article and summarizing it. And if you just follow these rules, you'll be okay. Well, of course, the summaries that I was writing ended up being crap, but there was no sort of immediate feedback. I mean, sometimes I'd be told not to begin a summary with a dependent clause or something, but the only standards were these generic ones of grammar. I was never told that this doesn't actually match the article. So there was this disconnect, and actually that disconnect with the product was actually necessary in order to meet this quota, because the more you actually think, it would just slow you down.
That makes a lot of sense. The more you think, the more it slows you down. And yet that's, I'm sure, was in the job description, if not written, implied that, of course, you'd have to be a good thinker to write what you needed to write for this. And you didn't.
Well, that's the irony, is that I got the job because I had this master's degree.
Right.
So the master's degree actually kind of covered over this more real stupidification of the work itself. And the other part of this is that the salary was $23,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And before this, I had worked as an electrician. I was an unlicensed electrician, and I was making easily twice that on most days, and sometimes three times that on the best days. And and felt sort of free and active rather than confined and stultified. So the irony to me is that with this MA degree, I felt like I'd been inducted into this order of society, and I was going to wear really nice ties, and I did, but it turned out to be a more proletarian life than I had known as an electrician.
Well, I'm glad you had a chance to wear really nice ties, which makes us think about, and this is a big part of the book and about of you, of what kind of work is genuinely useful and has a certain integrity to us. To it. I would imagine that's kind of a guiding philosophy of your life.
Well, yeah, and it's a struggle to find work that that has a kind of integrity to it and that can satisfy some basic human needs. I think, you know, the one problem with office work often is that the chain of cause and effect can be kind of confusing and opaque, and responsibility tends to get spread around. And one thing I like about the trades, this is going to sound strange, but is that your failures are actually very immediate. So, for example, one time I dropped a feeler gauge down into the crankcase of a motorcycle that was practically brand new. And when that happens, you know, you look around and there's no one else that you can blame. And so it's an experience of sort of this crushing catastrophe that's really vivid. It takes place right in front of you. And so there's a, I think there's a habit of paying attention that develops in the trades through kind of hard experiences like that. And when you're dealing with a physical reality, it usually lets you know right away when you've done something wrong. Whereas when you're doing work that's kind of abstract, often you don't get that immediate feedback, and I think it's easier to kind of continue on mistaking theory for reality.
Right.
Yeah.
So what did you do? How did you get it out?
Well, it was an operation that involved another pair of trusted hands of a friend, a stethoscope, and the kind of concentration I think they usually associate with a bomb squad. It involved the use of a magnet on a very long stick, but the problem is that the feeler gauge itself was stainless steel, so it only had just a tiny bit of magnetic qualities. So this, we used a stethoscope to hear when I had actually grabbed the feeler gauge.
And I want to talk a little, if there is a dichotomy here, because the thing that's striking about your life, Matthew, is that you are both a philosopher and a mechanic, but I'm wondering about the integrity and the value of work when you're also the director of a think tank, which you've also done. Do you see sort of kind of a jarring juxtaposition here between fixing motorcycles and being the director of a think tank? And I guess I also want to know, there must be something about using the mind and the number of years you've spent in school, actually, that is also has a certain integrity to it. Am I wrong?
Well, I absolutely loved graduate school. I was at the University of Chicago, and it's a really special place. And the life of the mind has been something that's a big part of my life. Ironically, not really till after college. It was after college that I got interested in philosophy. So I got my PhD, and the academic job market was totally depressing. But I landed this job at this policy place in Washington, and it felt like a coup. A think tank, it sounds like it's going to be a very academic-y kind of thing, but it actually turned out to be quite different because, like any policy place, you know, it had arrived at certain positions, and there were some facts it was more fond of than other facts. I often found myself having to kind of reason backwards from some desired conclusion to a suitable premise. So, you know, I found myself making arguments that I didn't fully buy myself.
Oh.
And that was kind of demoralizing.
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a full bank of phone lines actually lit. Matthew Crawford is our guest. He is the author of Shop Class as Soulcraft, An Inquiry into the Value of Work. He is the owner and operator of Shakomoto, pretty good name, huh? An independent motorcycle repair shop in Richmond, Virginia, and also a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll start phone calls because there are many of them for Matthew. Rich from Sullivan is our first caller. Hi, Rich.
Hi. The publication of Matt's, if I may call him that, Matt, essay on Sunday in the New York Times really caught my attention because early in it he says, trades suffer from low prestige based on a simple mistake because the work is dirty. Many people assume it's also stupid. And I think that's absolutely true. I worked for 34 years in a technical college in Wisconsin, and I'm not going to claim any trade knowledge because I was an English teacher at that school, and I used to joke in the faculty meetings that that basically English being or communication skills being required at the college should also be called the English Teachers Full Employment Act, because from time to time students would say to me, I think I already know this stuff, and I would say, I think you do, but let's make the best of it that we can. And I'm going to buy this book, but with a caveat, I'm going to urge everyone to buy his book and to do it by not going out to a big box store, but finding the smallest, most independent bookstore that you can and buying it there. And I think Matt will understand why I'm saying that. I also, if I may, just mention that on this topic, we need a whole range of programs on Wisconsin Public Radio, Kathleen. We need a book club that directs us to a Wendell Berry novel called Remembering, and we need to have a book club about Alfred Lebrano's Limbo, Blue Collar Roots and White Collar Dreams, and even a sometimes Jeremiah of a book, not completely good but very provocative, Jim Goad's The Redneck Manifesto, because we've lost touch with how important it is to understand what comes through manual labor. I was lucky enough to be raised among hunters. I'm not a hunter, but I came to an understanding of a reverence for whatever is on the table because there was a connection to what was on the table. And I think we've lost that. And I think this is a very, very important book. Sorry for going on so
long. Okay, Rich.
Hey, thanks, Rich.
Thank you, Rich, so much for the call. And we should tell you, if you don't have the book yet, and I like the idea of a small bookstore going to buy it there, he also has a provocative piece in the May 24 New York Times, The Case for Working with Your Hands. Christine from Madison is our next caller. Hi, Christine.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was very excited to hear this topic because I used to serve as a gifted and talented coordinator for a whole series of school districts. And I would meet with my students, and I would say, so why are you thinking about college? And I was encouraging them to go to technical schools. I said, first of all, you don't have to take out student loans. You can work. And I showed salary differences, but people who finished college and people who worked in the trades were very different. Well, the school systems weren't too happy with me because I was taking all their college prep students, and they were, you know, all of a sudden appearing in these applied classes that very often were shop classes. But my students were very happy, and the interesting thing is I went on to get a PhD, and I had to go over to England to study what they teach as design concepts, K-12. They teach people how to not only build things, but think about how to build things and use that whole thought process of designing things as a way to build good consumers and good repairers and good thinkers for whatever they do.
That's a great story. Matthew?
Yeah, well, both Rich and Christine had a lot of food for thought there. Just picking up on the education thread that Christine brought up, I actually taught high school very briefly for 1 year part-time, and what they had me teaching was Latin. And
of course.
Well, yeah, and I was excited that the principal said our Latin program is growing, and I was like, wow, what, you know, is there like a resurgence of interest in classical civilization or something? Well, it was very naive of me. What it was that kids were being told they had to take it to get their SAT scores up. And the class was kind of a disaster, and I'm sure part of that was that I'm just maybe not very gifted as a teacher, but it was also true that, you know, maybe 1 in 30 of these kids had an intrinsic interest in the language, and the rest of them, you know, this SAT rationale just couldn't sustain the kind of effort involved to learn these, you know, these noun declensions. And what made it frustrating was that I was sure that if I could have taken some of these kids aside and said, hey, let's build a deck together.
Yeah.
Or let's overhaul this engine, that they would have perked right up.
Yep.
You know, and maybe not needed quite so much Ritalin.
Yeah, I agree.
So there's a question of what sparks that love of learning.
They were in favor of that.
I'm sorry, Christine, what?
The schools that these gifted and talented students, they wanted to keep them in the college track. They didn't like me encourage them to take shop classes, you know, to use their hands. And I thought, that's the way they need to learn how to think most clearly, most critically, is by using their hands.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And I think it's also true, as you say as well, that some kids are kind of getting hustled off to college when they'd rather be learning to build things or fix things. And you know, when people get to college, a big issue now is that a lot of them are on antidepressants and just feel that it's not quite the right place for them. And I think, you know, the guy who becomes a B or C student in college, and let's say he goes on to be maybe a mediocre accountant, well, the tragedy is that that same guy might have made a crack electrician, be more engaged in what he's doing and good at it.
Hmm. So how do you know that?
How do I know that?
Yeah, no. How do people know what it is that will inspire them? What is good work for them?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a process of discovery for everybody. But if we're thinking about our institutions, I think the crucial thing is just to have these options available and to not have the mindset of trying to herd everybody into one track. You know, we talk a lot about diversity in education, but we don't have much accommodation for the kind of diversity of dispositions. And some people just aren't well suited to sitting in an office all day.
Right. A lot of people aren't suited.
And that includes people who are very smart.
Sure. And yet you also taught Latin. You learned Latin. I was convinced by doing a show on Shakespeare a couple of weeks ago that we should all learn Latin because
it's a beautiful language.
And because of his knowledge of it, he was Shakespeare. He probably needed to have some Latin.
Sure.
So what about that?
Well, you know, I learned Latin when I was probably 30. And if you tried to teach it to me when I was 17, there is no way in hell. So I think there has to be a felt need. And, you know, this idea that education only happens in school and that it only happens, but you know, up until age 22, is just not right. And so it's just a matter of finding where that felt need is.
Right. I feel like I love what I do. As you can imagine, it's a great job, but I feel like I go to school every day. It's wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Christine, thank you very much. And then I was also thinking, as we were talking about other work, it may explain why many of us feel this great need to go out and work with the dirt, to make gardens, to plant vegetables. Mm-hmm. And more of that is happening now, partially for economic reasons. But it's sort of that need to do something with our hands that's useful, right? It's a part of all of us, no matter what we do.
I think that's right. And so, as you mentioned, gardening, there's a lot of people taking up knitting. And,
yes.
And the book, Shop Class as Soul Craft, is about that, too. It's not just about work. It's also about our efforts to achieve some kind of self-reliance at home as consumers. And it's also about the ways that has become a real struggle. So think about the fact that the Sears catalog years ago used to have blown up parts diagrams for all the appliances that they sold, because it was just taken for granted that that kind of information would be demanded by the consumer, and how far we've come from that. So to take an example, some of the current Mercedes-Benz models don't even have a dipstick. So you can't check your own oil level. And I don't know about anyone else, but I'm kind of creeped out by that. And, you know, it used to be that in addition to a dipstick, you had something called an idiot light. And it was called an idiot light for the reason, you know, for a good reason. Anyone who was sort of so oblivious that they let their oil get that low, you know, we had a harsh judgment about that. But there's some weird cultural logic by which that kind of lack of involvement gets recast as something desirable, right? It's technological progress.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, I think there's this pervasive feeling that of kind of remote control. That with some cars now, I know you, when your oil level gets low, you get an email from someplace.
No.
Yeah. So it's like this process of sort of becoming less responsible for our own world. And Rich, the first caller, mentioned, you know, hunting and seeing food from the field to your table and having this kind of very direct relationship to it. I think that experience has become very elusive. We try to get it, and it's just become harder to get that experience.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Michael from Madison. Hi, Michael.
Howdy. Hello. You hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, first I'll say that my son that I'm going to talk about is an avid trials motorcycle rider.
Right on.
Since you're in the motorcycle business. But what I'm finding with kids that don't do hands-on, that they almost lose the ability to do work with their hands, that everything is so electronically orientated, and nobody's really starting these kids out at a young age to really, and I joke with people because I say, that kid knows how to hammer a bolt and twist a nail, and if they nod their head yes, I know that we just went over their head, and both my kids now, we're involved with the Rock River Threshery and do some blacksmithing down there, and it's just, I just think that it improves their mental mindset as growing up and having the ability to look at things and just a whole different attitude towards mechanical things and how things work, how things go together, how to make pieces, mm-hmm. how to make the pieces fit. And that's kind of the way that I grew up. My dad and my grandfather were inventors, and I grew up with a metal lathe in the basement and two table saws and a bandsaw and a joiner.
Sounds like a pretty good-sized basement.
It's getting awful hard to pass that down.
Yeah.
And the schools that has been discussed on your program are not really getting any friendlier towards that type of thing.
Yeah, there's efforts in some states to revive shop. I think there's some recognition now that it's important. And it's interesting, there's anecdotal evidence that one of the fastest growing parts of the student body population at community colleges is people who already have a four-year degree and return to get some trades skill that's going to be more marketable. Just last week, I had the great pleasure of visiting this school called the North Bennett Street School, which is in Boston. And it's a trade and craft school. It's been there since the 1800s. And I walked into this room, this was a cabinet shop, and there must have been 20 students in there, and the only sound that you heard was this scraping of planes and chisels. It was just, the level of quiet concentration was very impressive and unlike anything I'd ever seen when I was teaching high school.
Well, if it's true, I was listening to Michael talk, it seems to me as though there are going to be all kinds of jobs that nobody knows at this point how to do anymore.
Yeah, there's actually an interesting argument made by an economist named Alan Blinder at Princeton that the emerging distinction in the labor market is not going to be between those with more education and those with less. It's between those who have to do their work on site and those who have some service that can be delivered over a wire. And if you have to do it on site, then your job is secure against outsourcing. So, for example, what an electrician does, what a carpenter does, as Blinder says, you can't hammer a nail over the internet. And likewise, the Indians can't fix your car for you because they're in India. What we're learning is that the same logic that made manufacturing leave our shores to such a disturbing degree, namely that if you can put it on a container ship, it's going to be made somewhere else more cheaply. Well, that same logic now applies to the products of intellectual labor. So a radiologist who examines images, well, that can be done more cheaply in India. They have very educated people over there, and then the image is transmitted through a wire. The upshot is that if you can find work that resists that kind of outsourcing logic, you're better off.
Right. Thank you, Michael, so much for your call. Let's go to Kim is next from Cottage Grove. Hi, Kim.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'd like to touch on so many different aspects of this. I just don't even know where to begin. I have three college degrees. And was an engineer and was a researcher for a number of years. And then when my children grew too old for daycare and then went into the school system and I wouldn't have enough time to cover vacation days and sick days to cover their time off from school, like early release days and comp days and stuff like that, I went from being a employed engineer, and then I was a stay-at-home mom for 6 years, but then I opened up a paint-your-own pottery studio. And so people come to my shop and make fused glass items, and they make pottery items, and we have wheels and we have glasses and stuff. And the whole thing about this is that is such a disconnect from people creating, and they do so much electronically nowadays that the ability to help other people also create is really important. And our business is just growing by leaps and bounds because you are connecting people to their ability to go ahead and make items. And a lot of people didn't know that they were really missing this and are missing it. So I think in our electronic world and in our world where we communicate by, cell phone and text messaging and stuff like that, that it's really nice to go someplace and actually have the ability to make something. And I'd also like to say about the schools, I was never encouraged to go into the crafts, and in high school I was debating whether to go into a regular college or go to Rhode Island School of Design and do art, and it was always sort of discouraged to do that, so I took the more traditional route and got an engineering degree, even though that's not traditional for women back in the
80s. No, it's not.
Yeah, but still, there was never really encouragement for trades and for art. You know, it's kind of like you're sort of like, well, what would you want to go do that for?
Right.
Yeah.
Matthew.
But, I just love the guests, and I love the fact that, you know, we think really hard and we're problem solving all the time. And I have to say that this is probably my most fulfilling job I've ever had, in terms of a complete person and the ability to use both sides of my brain and everything.
It's interesting. I was just reading an article yesterday by a neuroscientist named Kelly Lambert. Apparently there's some good brain research on why it's so satisfying to work with your hands. It's from an evolutionary perspective that somehow when you're using your hands to do something where you're producing some result that's like genuinely useful, that it activates this connection between the part of your brain that's responsible for pleasure, the part that's responsible for sort of rational thought, and your hands. I'm sure I'm getting this not quite right, but in any case, it was sort of giving a scientific basis for this, what everyone already knows, which is that there's just a lot of satisfaction from doing that.
It is, you know, I listened to your story, both of your stories, actually, and I think, how does anybody have enough time to become so skilled in so many different areas, and you think so many disparate areas? It's quite a life, isn't it, Kim? It's a big life.
Oh, my God, I love it. I mean, I have people come from 2 hours away to Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, to be at my shop. That blows my mind, you know, that people, like, go that far, but that's because also really, you know, great customer service and stuff like that. But, you know, also we're just really active people. I don't watch a lot of TV. I don't do sort of the normal social things. Back in college, I was always like growing my own garden, and I made like all my own bread and stuff like that, and I canned. And people were like, how do you have time for it? And I didn't have a TV back in college, so that's how I had time. And I used to tell them that, and they think I was just brushing them off, but it's true. And you can listen to public radio while doing all of this stuff too. So, you know, there you go.
What a life. Thanks, Kim. Thank you very much for your call. Here's an interesting email from Barbara in Stevens Point. My husband is one of those geniuses who works with his hands via his creative, intelligent brain. There have been very few things that he has not been able to fix. My mother, a number of years ago, brought him her 50-plus-year-old Toastmaster toaster that still had the cloth cord and asked him to fix it. It won't make toast brown enough, she said. My husband threw it away 3 times and dragged it from the trash bin 3 times, but finally was able to fix it. It still works with a new cord, of course. The toaster was purchased in the late 30s or early 40s. Oh. That's a great story, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm interested in hearing more of your thoughts about self-reliance. Self-reliance as consumers, self-reliance in our homes. And let's just start with your life. How do you feel that you are a self-reliant person? What does it mean for us, and how do we learn that? How do we accomplish self-reliance?
Yeah, it's tough because of the kind of changes in material culture. I mean, that toaster from the 1930s is probably a lot easier to fix than one from today because, you know, first of all, you can probably take it apart. You can find the screws. Often stuff now is, like, it's designed to not even be able to get it apart. So you have to be really determined to have that kind of self-reliance. And we talked before about the there not even being a dipstick on your engine, and more generally, you lift the hood on some cars now, and it's like there's another hood under the hood. It's kind of everything is out of sight. So I don't really have a prescription for how to be more self-reliant. Personally, I like older cars. I like cars that are simpler, and just as importantly, that there are lots of inexpensive parts for. So, you know, if I knew that the sort of the end days were coming, I would want a 1960 VW Bug or something, just because it's something you always can fix yourself. But it's as far as a practical matter. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. And as you go through your day, I mean, you obviously know how to fix all kinds of things, but do you live differently than most of us because you've really nurtured your fix-it side?
Oh, I don't know. It's, you know, you gotta choose your battles, and I use up just as much disposable crap as the next person, where it's not worth the time. It always kills me to do that. I'll put something aside and it'll linger for years, you know, under my workbench thinking someday I'm going to, crack that plastic cover open and get to it. But the economics of it can be so perverse, you know, where we're getting a replacement part costs, you know, like 80% of getting the new one. So it's, I think it's something we have to rethink at a macro level of the economy of this kind of throwaway society, and it's and try to remove some of these barriers to individuals being self-reliant. Mm-hmm. And there is a sort of movement afoot to manufacture things in a different way, where they would be more accessible, more sort of directly intelligible when you look at them, have a clear way of getting it apart. And I hope that gathers some steam.
Let's pause for just a moment. We'll return. Our guest is Matthew Crawford. He is the author of Shop Class as Soulcraft, an inquiry into the value of work. If I tell you what he does, well, to say nothing, I won't say of what he has done. He has a PhD in political philosophy from the University of Chicago. He's a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia and the owner and operator of Shakomoto, an independent motorcycle repair shop in Richmond, Virginia. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Matthew, and Josh is next from Round Lake, Illinois. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Thanks for taking my call. I kind of have a unique background. Currently what I do is I'm an engineer and product designer with a lot of experience with computer stuff, designing and modeling on a computer, but my education was totally informal. I've been doing it for 8 years, and I was hired as a junior designer, junior mechanical engineer by a company, because the first thing I did was made something myself. They never bothered to ask whether I was a degreed engineer. And they just saw that I took the action to make the product that they were developing, and they hired me to do that. Since then, I've been grandfathered in and have taken a unique path of doing learning as an action as opposed to being passive. So my career has been developed by taking the action of learning all the different aspects of my job, whether it's modeling plastic or metal parts. I took the action of making those things first, and the value that I've brought to my customers, whether working independently or the companies that I have worked for, has been huge. And most recently, I was hired by a university in Milwaukee to teach graduate students how to do the same thing. They have to make things, but they don't know how to make things. So they're hiring me. I wouldn't call myself totally uneducated, because for the past 8 years I've kind of educated myself through work experience. But one of the disconnects I see is the idea of learning through action, and why the educational system isn't picking up on this and saying, look, there's people who are bringing value, and this value to companies and so on and so forth, this value we aren't giving them, they're finding on their own, you know, through action of building or tinkering or so on and so forth. And I think it's kind of interesting, because I just turned on the radio today, and right now I'm going to meet with a customer about some design work that I did, and later on I'm taking a half day to work on restoring my car. So, and the value that I gain in doing that restoration myself, this hands-on, this getting dirty, it's something that my coworkers don't have. They're in the office. Some of them have not stepped out and touched a product that they've designed or manufactured for years. And I find it troubling, and I see why disposable products are created, because they don't work on them themselves. So I think it's kind of interesting that isn't being taught, or that the educational system isn't taking that path. And I thought it was very ironic that I was hired to do what I'm doing right now. So, that's my comment, and I can take a response off the air.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad you were listening and called.
Josh's story is great. From what I've heard, there's kind of a glut of formally trained engineers, but that someone like Josh is in extremely high demand. So there's something a little bit out of whack in terms of our priorities, but guys like Josh are able to profit from that. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Molly from River Falls. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I know that you're formally trained and you went to you got this standard education, being like a 4-year degree and then beyond. I kind of have that same situation. I obtained my 4-year degree. My husband, however, went to tech school, and obviously most of his friends also went to tech school. It seems as though most of my friends from the 4-year college are either not working in their field of study, or they're just not working at all, or can't find a job in their field of study, versus all of my husband's friends are employed directly in the field of study that they went to the tech school for. And I'm just wondering if that's kind of a universal observation. I'm actually considering going back to a tech school situation to get formal training in something hands-on. I really see a value in working in that situation.
Yeah, I think when you have a real trade, you've got something that's always going to be in demand, I think. I guess the idea with college usually is that you're not learning anything in particular. You're sort of learning to think. But as several of our callers have pointed out, the kind of thinking that you learn from a book, while it can be, you know, very stimulating mentally, it sometimes has a kind of disconnect from the world, and it can be hard to make a living using that knowledge. So I think that the economic rationale for learning a trade matches up nicely with the kind of psychic rationale of feeling connected to something that's real and satisfying.
Right.
What are you thinking of learning? Do you know yet, Molly?
I'm not. It's something to do with cars. My husband works in cars, and it's he makes almost as much as I do, whereas I went to school for a much longer time, and it just seemed like an extensive investment in my education with a very little payback. So I think it'd be fun to work in the same situation that he does.
Interesting.
Thanks very much for the call. If for whatever reason, and obviously life doesn't work this way, but do you go through spurts at all? And if you had to make a choice, and maybe you do, between doing motorcycle repair work and somebody offered you a job at the school you always wanted to be teaching something that you really loved, that stimulated your mind more than anything, would that be a difficult decision for you, Matthew?
Well, I don't think that I'm really gifted as a teacher, so teaching doesn't really tempt me that much. I do like being able to, you know, talk about books with people, and I've had this great fellowship at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at UVA doing that. But it's for me, it's great to be able to kind of balance that out with real, and I don't want to call it real work, but work that has a very different character to it. And you know, fixing motorcycles is something that would be very hard to give up, and I don't plan to.
And do you ride them as well?
Yeah, I do. Not quite as much now, having two toddlers. I have to make excuses for going on a ride, but it's part of the job. I mean, I'm out, you know, test ride bikes when I finish them, and so it's part of the life.
Right. Well, this will be interesting now with two toddlers to see how you raise your children, what skills they're taught, and where they go to school. And
yeah, they're both girls, and I can't wait to to tear apart an engine with them and teach them stuff. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's take we got 30 seconds, but I'm sure, Dan, you can make your comments in 30 seconds, can you? Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I'll hit on the part that I told your screener, and that is I'm a retired mechanic. I get tremendous satisfaction from being able to fix things. But the other thing that comes with it is being able to, the environmental satisfaction. When you can recycle old 90 Hondas forever and ever, when you can recycle a broken electric drill, the pollution created from manufacturing that drill and disposing of it is still, you haven't replaced it with another one and created that pollution again. So there's some great green satisfaction that comes from it.
Yes, I'm sure. It's a good way to end the show. Thank you so much for the call. Matthew, thank you very much for being with us. Matthew Crawford, philosopher and mechanic. His book is Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work. It has just been published by Penguin Press. He also, if you'd like to go to the New York Times, May 24, his piece on the case for working with your hands. Thanks to Mimi Notstein for producing this hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, of course, for all of your calls. They're always, almost always, so good. Until tomorrow, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.